Growing up, my dad and I didn't always see eye to eye. We loved each other, and I certainly revered and respected him, but it could be difficult sometimes to find ways to relate in day-to-day conversation. Part of that, I think, is just the struggle any young man has trying to relate to his father. When you think about it, the power dynamic is just not very conducive to a genuine friendship. Your dad is this much older man that you live with in his home during a time in your life when you're almost completely dependent on him. And he is charged with the responsibility of making sure that you have clothes, food, shelter, and a reasonable amount of happiness. I think that's why so many people wind up becoming better friends with their parents as they age. You just start to understand your parents better as people as you grow and start to realize more about what they were juggling emotionally while trying to provide you with a good birthday party when you were 10. You start to be more forgiving and understanding of their shortcomings as you become more knowledgeable of the many ways in which the adult version of you falls short on a daily basis. Now, don't get me wrong. My father and I have a very strong relationship that I'm very proud of and extremely grateful for. But I'm just saying all this to set up the purpose of this episode and to state honestly that we didn't always have the connection we do now. I think he'd agree that we struggled in the past to understand each other. I think my father, a CPA who ran a successful business that he built from the ground up, all while maintaining his social status as a scratch golfer, could never really understand the impracticality of a person who is willing to forego money and security in the pursuit of passion in a very insecure career in the arts. And I, a kid who revered Van Gogh and Monet more than any millionaire, could never understand how a person could actually enjoy the agonizing torture of golf. I'm starting to get it a bit more now, but that's a conversation for another day. These days, my dad and I can talk about just about anything. We talk about movies, philosophy, politics, podcasts, music, you name it. But it wasn't always like that. For a good portion of my 20s, my dad and I were fundamentally opposed when it came to politics, religion, or just about any form of personal ideology. During that time, and for much of my childhood, one of the only reliable things we could see eye to eye on and have a strong, productive conversation about was college football. For about 3 to 4 months every year, we would have weekly discussions on how our team, the University of Utah Utes, were shaping up that season. We'd commiserate together when the team would lose, and we'd celebrate together when they'd win. We still do this every year. We have weekly detailed breakdowns of the games. We have strong opinions about controversial calls by the referees. We go watch the team together when they play on the road. We are invested, and it's fun. Sometimes it doesn't look like we're having fun because we get so damn emotional about it, but I can say for my part that I look forward to college football season each year more than I look forward to maybe any other part of the year. Now, my love for the game has evolved beyond my desire to simply connect with my dad. I have my own deeply rooted respect for it now. But even though my dad and I have much more to talk about these days, it's still one of our favorite topics. This year, our beloved Utes have not begun their season, and as of the date that I am recording this intro, it is still unknown whether their conference, the Pac-12, will wind up playing or not. They are the only Power 5 conference in college football to not play now that the Big Ten has announced they will begin in early October. And while I understand why the decision not to play was made, and I certainly don't expect anything to happen normally in a year as quintessentially unique as 2020, I can't help but miss the games. I've never had a year without them, and it just feels wrong. If this were a normal year, we'd be 2 weeks into the regular season by now, and I'd be on the phone every day with my dad and my brother Anthony, breaking down the highs and lows from the first two games and making our best predictions about the upcoming matchups. But this isn't a normal year. So, in lieu of donning our red gear and heading to Rice-Eccles Stadium to watch a game and sing our favorite fight song, I thought I'd have my dad on the podcast to talk about one of our oldest and most trusted topics. We'll be talking about what we love about the game, but also about the ethical dilemmas inherent in the game and what our feelings are on those. We'll be breaking it all down, the way we've done for years, as father and son. From a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking with my father, Mike Archer, about college football. It's weird. This is really weird. I look forward to this every single year, you know, like if like I look forward to it like Christmas or like but it's like a 3 month long Christmas and we're not doing it this year. At least so far as we know. We're not doing it. What's your what are your earliest memories with college football?
Well, I started attending college football games probably when I was a boy, like 7, 8 years of age. Mm-hmm. I would go with my two brothers and my father.
Yeah.
And my mom, back, this would be in the 60s, she was a school teacher. And she did her weekly grocery shopping on Saturday. So she'd go Saturday morning, and she'd go to Safeway. I don't know that Safeways even exist anymore. They've probably been
I think they exist outside of Utah.
Maybe.
I feel like I just went to one in Washington when I was driving through.
Okay. So she would go to a Safeway grocery store, do the family's weekly grocery shopping, and would buy $2 tickets to the football game that was to be held that given Saturday.
Was that – that's not like equivalent inflation-wise. That's still low, right?
That's really low. And yeah, I mean, if you put an inflation rate on that, it'd be like, I don't know what, 20, 30 times, maybe 50, 60
yeah.
times, increase since those days. These were general admission tickets, but back in those days at the University of Utah, there were only, I'd say less than half the seats were reserved.
Yeah.
So most of them were general admission. And most of the games, not all, but most of the games were in the afternoons, like a noon, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock start. There was a few night games. But so she would, back to my mother, she'd do the grocery shopping. She'd come home. And of course, you know, we were as interested in those tickets as we were in anything that she purchased for the
yeah.
family. And then we would go with our father. And
Would your mom go to the game or would she just purchase the tickets for the boys?
My mom in those days didn't go to the games.
Yeah.
'Cause,
did Kathy go?
No, Kathy didn't go either. My sister
yeah.
didn't go.
Yeah.
Just the dad and three sons. And then after a few years, because my older brother, Lee, is 7 years older than me, by the time I was like 10 years of age and Paul would have been six, it was just Paul and I and my dad and our dad. Because Lee, by then, was a teenager doing teenage things, and then he was off to college. And if he went to the games while he was in college, which he did, he sat in the student section. But my mother didn't go. Kathy didn't go. My mom had other things. She wanted to go to the beauty salon and different things on a Saturday afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
So we would go to the games. And, in the 1960s, the University of Utah was a decent team, not a great team, but a decent team. Our biggest rival was probably, Utah State, really. It wasn't BYU because we beat BYU every year. It wasn't even close.
Mm.
It was a rival. And I remember the first time my dad took us down to Provo to see the game, he affectionately called the BYU team, the Dirty Cougars. And so he said, we're going down to Dirty Cougarville, and we're going to go watch the football game down there. So
a moniker which proudly still exists in our family.
Yeah.
The Dirty Cougs.
He would say it with a twinkle in his eye. I found out later on, let me just say that, in the 1970s, of course, early 1970s, Lavelle Edwards took over at BYU, and then for like 25 years, the rivalry became a rivalry, and it turned in BYU's favor, and Utah won, I think, twice in 25 years.
The way you're describing it, when you say that we always used to beat them, that's when I was growing up, it was like Utah State was just – it was a game that happened every year, and they called it the Battle of the Brothers, and it was like that. But it was we didn't concern ourselves with whether or not we were going to be able to beat Utah State. It was just a given that we were most likely going to beat them.
Exactly.
And only till recently, Utah State with Gary Anderson and with Matt, what's his name?
Matt Wells.
They've become a pretty good team. Pretty solid program, but goes up and down.
Yeah, exactly. It did change. But Lavelle Edwards came, and then BYU became this national power and just just moved ahead of Utah and even won a national championship. And, of course, that was really hard on Utah fans. I found out, I didn't know this until 1985, but I found a letter one day when I was visiting my parents, I found a letter that my dad had received from Lavelle Edwards. And I said, how did you get a letter from Lavelle Edwards? He said, well, we're friends. So my dad met Lavelle Edwards when Lavelle was the head coach at Granite High School in the late 1950s. And they lived in the same neighborhood.
Yeah.
They were neighbors. So he had had developed a friendship with Lavelle, and he just sent him a letter congratulating him on his national championship, and Lavelle returned the letter with a thank you and, a note.
For college football fans, Lavelle's like a known name. For Utah people, he's a household name, but for college football fans, he's a known name. He's a
Hall of Fame coach,
but for people who don't know, he's the coach of BYU who led them to their one and only national championship, debated by Utah fans because they got it kind of on a technicality in a time when if the same rules had existed, Utah probably would have one for their 2008 season. But
the way things worked in that era, and so
they got a national championship.
They got a national championship, and boy, for them, they were undefeated. They won every game.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's how I got started in football, going with my dad and with my brothers. And
do you remember a time when when the sport clicked for you? Because for me, it was always a family thing that I knew. The most that I think I knew about it was like we're a Utah team, and some of my friends at school and like our neighbors next door to the Swans are a BYU team, and all I really knew about it was we're right and they're wrong, and I don't know why, it's like it's in your blood, it's in your DNA, but I didn't really understand the sport or the intricacies of it until a certain point. For me, it seems like it clicked around that. Like 2002 season when Urban Meyer first showed up. I think that was around the time that I first started really paying attention to the game and paying attention to the things that I think I still love about it now. But I think before then it was just sort of who has more points at the end of the game, us or them? And I didn't really know how we got to that point. Was there a point for you where you feel like it started to click, that it started to make sense? Or?
Oh, yeah. Well, for me it was earlier. Probably when I was just a boy, 8, 9 years of age.
Yeah,
that's when I really became interested, and it meant a lot to me. And I would get into the games and to the conference schedule and the rivalries and the players. I've always been kind of a numbers guy, and I didn't realize this was maybe a little bit unusual or fanatical, that's where we get the term fan.
Yeah.
But I would memorize the roster. And so I knew every player's name, number, where they were from, their height, weight, age, year in school, position, and some of their statistics.
Wow.
I knew all this stuff from the program. And I don't know, I just figured everybody did it. But it got to the point where, you know, if a player ran in, my family would say, who is that? What does he play? What, you know?
I think Anthony's still that way. Anthony, I know a lot of the players on the roster, but Anthony knows where everyone's from, where they played junior college,
yeah,
or where they play, you know, like what kind of recruit they were. Were they a 3-star, a 4-star, a 5-star recruit? I don't know that stuff.
And it was, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, of course, you couldn't find it online. There was no World Wide Web.
Yeah, to like get a program.
Yeah,
from
you
got to
get a program. By the way, I saved those programs.
Yeah.
And I would keep them in my bedroom from year to year to year. I had all these programs and I'd read everything in the program. It was really kind of crazy. So I was a fanatical fan.
Yeah.
Here's a memory of how into football I kind of became as a fan. So when I was a junior in high school, I was 16 years of age, and I had to have back surgery. And back then, I had taken a weight training class. Well, it was more of a, here's the weights, guys, and we'll play basketball afterwards. There was no training involved.
Right.
And I ruptured a disc in my back, because I didn't know proper technique or form. And so I needed back surgery, and I had surgery in September 1969. And in those days, you were in the hospital a long time. I was in there for 10 days.
Wow.
Today that would be outpatient surgery.
Yeah.
But I was in there for 10 days. And finally, on the 10th day, I begged the doctor to let me go home.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally let me go home, and so I'd been home and he gave me some instructions, brief instructions on things I should and shouldn't do. But one of the things was I shouldn't sit for very long periods of time, maybe 10 minutes at a time. Well, the next Saturday was a big game I wanted to see, Arizona State University, and that Utah's now in the same conference, the Pac-12 conference with, but in those days, we were both in the Western Athletic Conference, and they were a very good team.
And we've been in the same conference as them before?
Yeah, Western Athletic Conference.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so Arizona State was coming to town, and they were loaded with talent, and I wanted to see that game, and I convinced my parents to let me go. I went with my dad and my brother, but the condition was I had to stand the whole game. So you can't stand in front of other fans. So I went to the top of the stadium, and I stood the whole game and watched the game so that I wouldn't be sitting for 4 hours and, you know, aggravate the surgery or the healing from the surgery that I was experiencing. But we won. We won the game. We were the underdogs, and we won. So there was a big memory for me. It shows you how, you know, how much of a fan I was, because here I should have been probably just resting or recuperating, and I did want to go to... I don't think I went to school for another week after that. So I was out of school like three weeks, but I did go to the football game.
See, but I think it's incredible that... And I've always found this incredible that you've always been able to regale us with stories of games from, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, and you can remember who won, who lost, and I feel like... Yeah, the memories of being in the stands for these things. There's an energy in a football stadium when you're in stands with tens of thousands of fans, and you know, like I say, I always knew that our family was Utah fans and that I wore Utah red and that's what ran in my DNA. But when I first started remembering players and games and things, my first thing like that is us taking that trip to Colorado. We were going to go watch the Utes play Colorado State on a Saturday night and then watch the Denver Broncos play the Detroit Lions the next day.
Yeah.
And we didn't really care about the Broncos or the Lions. It was more about just watching an NFL game.
Yeah, we didn't care about an NFL game. We were concerned about the college football.
Yeah, but we were having a pretty good season. It was our first season with this new coach who everyone was really excited about. And the cool thing about that game was Colorado State had become something of a rival in the Mountain West, where it was sort of a back and forth season to season. They were marching down the field to end the game. I think they were winning by like 2 points or something, but they were going to, and they were going to maybe kick a field goal or just score a touchdown and put the game on ice. Cause it was like the last 30 seconds of the game. And they were just cruising down the field. They had this running back that had been running all over us all night long. And he was just marching them down the field. And as they're heading toward the end zone, Dave Revel, our star linebacker, comes around the outside, knocks the guy, and it's the running back, their star running back. He's coming around the edge, and Dave Revel knocks him, and the ball pops in the air, and Arnold Parker, the fastest guy on the team, catches the ball and runs 85 yards down the field for a touchdown, and we won the game. It was such a cool...
That was amazing.
Yeah, and I remember that. I remember vividly. I remember... the feeling of the momentum and the energy shifting in the stadium from where the majority of the stadium was just loving it because they felt like they were going to win to now the 5,000 Utah fans who had made the trip to watch the game were running the energy in the stadium. And I don't know, it's amazing how well those things stick. And I feel like I'm going to remember that for the rest of my life.
A moment frozen in time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was an amazing weekend and game. That was 2003.
Right.
Probably was October, late September, October.
And it was cold.
And we did. We saw the Broncos play the Detroit Lions the next day.
Don't remember that game.
I don't either. But I do remember the college game. We stayed with your Uncle Paul at his house in Colorado. Here's one where it ended... where the ending was different, and the pain from this the game that I'm going to mention, it was as vivid and deep as the exhilaration was on the night of that Utah at Colorado State game.
Yeah.
So in the 80s, I went up to watch Utah play at Wyoming, in Laramie, Wyoming. I think I went with my brother Paul. Who else would have gone? Maybe both my brothers, but we decided to go to the Utah at Wyoming game.
Yeah,
and we had a coach named Chuck Stobart. This would be like 1982 or 83.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've never been to a game in Laramie, Wyoming, it was actually a decent day in Wyoming, meaning it was clear, it wasn't snowing, but the temperature was in the low 40s, high 30s, and it was a little bit windy. And the Wyoming fans, they're hardy. They were in polo shirts. We had sweaters and windbreakers on and like ski hats. I mean, it was cold.
Yeah.
And we were ahead in the game by like 3 points.
Mm-hmm.
And we went on this long, it was about a 9-minute drive in the fourth quarter, and we were going to run the clock out or – you know, score right at the end to just put the game out of reach. And we got down to the 4-yard line of Wyoming. And literally, it was a 9 or a 10-minute drive. We had just basically taken all the time out of the game. There was about 40 seconds left in the game.
Yeah.
And, you know, we could just run the clock out there and the game would have been over. And we tried one more play and the running back got hit. The ball popped up like it did in the game you described, and a Wyoming player caught the ball and ran 96 yards the other way for a touchdown.
Oh, jeez.
And so we went from being up in the game by 3 points and being on the verge of winning the game, an away game, to losing the game by 4 points. And, you know, it was just so – and then we had to drive all the way back home, and we were so discouraged.
I choose not to – I try to not revisit those memories, but, yes, they are etched in my mind just as vividly. I I will always remember Kalen Clay dropping the ball on the one-yard line. And, get, you know, it's like, that's a game where, like, we were about to go up 14-0 on a ranked Oregon team that was widely considered one of the best teams in the country for the last few seasons.
Went to the playoff that year.
Yeah. And we're about to go up two scores on them early, which is kind of what you had to do with that team. You kind of had to, like, they weren't good at fighting it, digging their way out of a hole. But instead, we just hand them the momentum, just completely. Yeah. But man, yeah. I will. Those games are.
You know, I remember that game. I was a referee when I was younger. My brother Paul and I, we would referee Little League football and high school football.
Yeah.
So I do know the rules of football, and I know the mechanics that referees go through. And I remember as he crossed the goal line, and everybody was cheering. The score even went up for the touchdown on the scoreboard. But I wasn't cheering, and the people sitting around me said, how come you're not cheering? And I said, because the referees haven't signaled touchdown yet.
Yeah.
And I was watching the referees, and then, as you recall, the Oregon team's running the other way with the ball. And they actually went 99 yards the other way.
No whistles blown.
Yeah, no whistles blew. Yeah. No touchdown was signaled by the referee. And, you know, where most of the fans in the stadium were just going crazy. I'm watching the referees going, Houston, we have a problem.
It's actually a great catch by the referee, because the interesting thing about the way that the rules work in football is if they had just missed it and blown their whistle and signal touchdown, it's a touchdown.
It's a touchdown, right.
It doesn't matter if they have video replay and they go, oh, no, he actually dropped the ball as he was crossing into the end zone. If the whistles blow, it's over. It's a dead ball. You can't go back and redo the play and go, well, let's see what would have happened if we had.
Well, you can for a, now you can for a fumble, right?
Right.
I mean, they can. So,
but they would have had the ball on the one-yard line. They would have had to march 99 yards to get a score.
Yeah, because the ball, you're right. They would have.
Uh-huh. So it's a really interesting thing where, I mean, that's part of the game. That's one of those things in the game that I think frustrates fans, but it's also part of the game is you can win or lose a game on a call. I remember growing up and there was this game against Colorado State one year where Jacob Lyman, I remember the receiver's name, he caught a pass at the end of the end zone, and they said he was out of bounds. But video replay showed that he had about 6 inches of green between his knee and the white line. But it was at a time when once the call was made and the time had expired on the clock, there was no going back and redoing the call. So there was the end of the game, but it was like the video evidence was clear that it was a touchdown, but it didn't exist that you could I think challenge at that time, or, you know, but that's part of the game, and it still exists even with challenges, and they're doing this in the NBA more now with coaches' challenges and stuff like that, but it's still like bad calls and good calls, it's all part of the game. The referees are part of the game. One of my questions for you is along with that, but what are, in your mind, what do you think is like some of your favorite things about this sport? What makes it so unique or special to you? Because to me, I think that I enjoy it more than even pro football, and maybe I wouldn't feel that way if we had a pro football team in Utah, but there's elements to it that I'll go into, but I'll ask you first.
Well, I certainly like the allegiance that fans have to their schools. And again, I'm a Utah fan. I raised you, my children as Utah fans. Even your sister who went to BYU remained a Utah fan, and her daughters are Utah fans.
Damn straight.
You know, I married a BYU. Your mother's a BYU graduate.
Yeah.
And she's, I always tell people with tongue in cheek that she's my biggest convert. She converted from being a BYU fan.
It was your
to
biggest
a Utah
condition.
Fan. Yeah. Although early on, she did ask me a few times, now, why are we going to these Utah games when BYU's so much better? But I think that's the first thing. I like the fact that people really get into their schools, their school colors, their, you know, the mascots, and then the rivalries that are created by conferences, by a proximity to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being a school in the same state or the same geographic area. I love college football rivalries. I just think they're, and some of the great ones, like you've got Notre Dame, a team from the Midwest, the most recognized, recognizable independent program in the country, and maybe the most successful program in the history of college football, and USC, a team from the West Coast, or Notre Dame and Stanford. And then, of course, the one we have here, which is just, you know, for many, many years, several decades, has been great, is the BYU-Utah.
Yeah.
And I do not appreciate the when people bring religion or things like that into it, but
right.
But I guess it's part of it. But it is. It's really interesting, and the characters that have been part of that are just.
It's interesting being raised LDS and feeling and being so vitriolically opposed to the LDS team and being on the team because the game is you know sort of affectionately referred to as the Holy War you know in Utah, and I think that comes from there's a secular school and there's a private religious school that are going at each other in a very heavily religious state that is sort of the majority of people are part of this religion. But we were part of the religion, and like many LDS people, we were University of Utah fans.
Utah fans, yeah. Well, and here's another example of that. In 2000, it was the last year that Lavelle Edwards coached at BYU. He was there 29 seasons, 1972 through 2000.
Yeah.
And his last game of his last season was in Rice-Eccles Stadium against it was the rivalry game against Utah. And Utah was going to win the game. Late in the game in the fourth quarter, they were ahead. And BYU had a All-American running back named Luke Staley. And this is before booth review, before the referee, review came into being.
See, I do remember this.
Yes, and he gets hit, and he fumbles, but the referees call him down. So the play's over, and he's down. But the video of the game showed that he actually did fumble before his knee touched, and Utah would have recovered the ball, and the game would have been over. But BYU went down the field from that point and scored and won the game.
Yeah.
Well, the next year when the next season was beginning, now Lavelle had retired, and I went to a Crimson Club lunch, which I used to do almost every week. They're held infrequently now, but they would be weekly, and there'd be about 200 hardcore fans that would show up. And our coach was Ron McBride,
mm-hmm.
who's a good family friend, and has been really good to our family. And I was talking to Ron about the game. I said, Ron, you need to understand. And I was being a little bit, using a little levity with him. But I said, you need to understand that the Lord wanted to give Lavelle one more victory. And he said, the hell he did. Luke Staley, it was the referees who gave him one more victory. Luke Staley fumbled that ball. And so I knew that McBride was still seething and upset over losing that rivalry.
Of course, yeah. Well, and it's the allegiance that you talked about that gives those rivalry games such an energy, because that is all of my biggest, my greatest joys and my greatest heartbreaks have been in those games. And, you know, the amount of times I've watched BYU do some miracle thing at the end of the game to win the game, to win a game that we seem to be in control of for the majority of the time.
Right.
You know, Johnny Harleen in the end zone,
yep.
John Beck having what seemed like 10 minutes to find an open receiver.
Yeah.
And then
Max Hall to Austin Colley.
When they went 4th and 18,
yeah.
And Max Hall completes a 4th and 18, and then they continue the drive, and he gets it to Colley, yeah. And then Max Hall to what was his name? The tight end. George.
Andrew George.
Andrew George.
Yeah.
And
yep.
And you know that yeah. these, but then just as many as BYU's done that, Utah's done it the same way, yeah. where blocking the field goal at the, you know, when it was 17-16, in just a, what was it, 2 years ago, the comeback when it was, we were down 21-0 and put on a, just a, a roaring comeback to come back and win the game 35-28.
That was November of 2018. You know, another thing I like, you asked me what I like about football. I think it's this rivalry, but it's also one where rivals can be friends.
Yeah.
And I mentioned that game, Lavelle's last game, and how upset McBride was. But the reality was Ron McBride and Lavelle Edwards became dear friends.
Yeah.
And when Lavelle had surgery, it was late in the 90s. It was kind of a serious, I think it was a heart surgery. It was off season. Only family was allowed into the ICU after his surgery.
Uh-huh.
But Ron McBride got in by telling the nurses that he was Lavelle's brother. And he actually visited Lavelle. And when Lavelle's wife showed up, she said, "Ronnie, what are you doing in here?" He said, "I'm just here to see my buddy."
Right.
So, you know, that's the type of friendship. And then they ended up doing that radio program for years during football season. And, it's... So to me, it's a game where you can have intense rivalries, but also amazing friendships, and I think that's the way it should be. The fans should be friends. It should be all about a game and about the rivalry on the field, but before and after, you know, you can do some amazing things with friends. You can raise money for special causes. You can, you know, help people out who are in need of help. You can create these lasting friendships, and I think that's a great thing too about college football.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. I joke that, you know, I say I knew when growing up that we were right because we were Utah fans and BYU fans were wrong. But a lot of my best friends are BYU fans, you know, and a lot of people that I grew up with and that I'm still friends with to this day are BYU fans. It's not that I actually dislike people who are fans of BYU. Of course, I'm friends with people who are fans of BYU. It's just, and it's one of the reasons why I love going to away games is because, like you said, I love seeing the tradition on other people's campuses. I love seeing the passion. You walk through another person's campus, and I love the kind of mild-mannered ribbing that happens as you walk through an opposing team's tailgate, and they kind of like maybe go, "Oh, you guys are going down today," you know, but then it's also sort of joking And sometimes you run into people who are maybe a little drunk or a little, you know, where it gets a little bit not fun. But in general, you know, there can be good-natured sportsmanship after a game and even before a game where, you know, if you lose the game, an opposing team's fans will see you and they'll go, "Geez, you guys got a good team. That was a tough game. You know, like, I thought you guys had us there for a second," you know. And or if you win, they'll go, "Wow, you guys are going to go far this season. You know, that was really impressive." And there's obviously you want to win, but there's that sort of good-natured sportsmanship about it. And of course, the coaches know each other and are friends and get along. It's sort of like politics in that way, where we think of these people that we're voting for in these different parties as like they're bitter rivals. You know, they hate each other. But a lot of these people are colleagues who go to dinner and their families are, you know, go on vacations together.
Orrin Hatch and Ted Kennedy.
Yeah.
I mean, two really different people who became dear friends through their years in the United States Senate.
Well, the way that Ruth Bader Ginsburg talks about Antonin Scalia, that she's like, "Oh, well, he was, you know, I respect the man. Like, my colleague for years, you know?
Yeah, one extremely on the right side and one more liberal, but great friends and associates.
Well, because they just, I think they understand each other too. They have, at the end of the day, they have the same job.
And they respect each other and appreciate, you know, the work they put in to get where they are. And
Right. When you're both doing, it's kind of like, I don't have animosity toward other people who are getting acting jobs over me, toward my friends who I'm technically in competition with, and we wind up going out for the same things, but it's like, I'm happy for them when they succeed, and I also understand the energy and the what it takes to go through what they have to go through, and the rejection that they face. So while I'm disappointed if someone gets a job that I was up for that I didn't get, I'm also happy for them, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably how it is with players and coaches, and they have school pride or they have team pride, but at the end of the day, it's just a game.
Yeah.
What I was going to say one of my favorite things about this sport that I think even elevates it above the pro game for me is stakes. And I think that there's just, I don't know of another game with stakes like college football. Like one of the reasons I look forward to the season with bated breath and that I'm so excited for it every single year is because every single week feels so heavy. Even non-conference games that you're sure you're going to win, nothing's a gimme.
Yeah.
You take your eye off the ball.
There's only 12 regular season games, and you can hardly afford.
In today's game, you can't afford really.
To lose one.
Yeah.
Or, you know, maybe you can get by. But if you want to make a, if you want to win your conference or make a significant bowl game, or today, knock on wood, get into the national playoff.
Right.
Yeah, every game. It's so significant.
It's that way for every single team. I love that about it, but also I need to learn how to be emotional and be emotionally invested, because I do think being emotionally invested makes it fun, but do that without like ruining my night. We went to go watch them play USC last year, I remember at the beginning of the night, Mary said something like, "Oh, this is such a great night. I'm so glad we're here." And I said, "Well, it will be a great night if we win." And she goes, "Oh, it's going to be a great night no matter what. This is fun." I said, "No, I'm going to be in a bad mood if we lose." And she goes, "Why?" And I said, "Because we got to win this game. Yeah. I feel like we should win it. I feel like we have the ability to win it. And we really have to."
And what was really crazy about that game is we started out so well within, I think it was the first series, we put their quarterback out of the game.
Yeah.
And actually, that ended up being a detriment to us.
Yeah.
Because the guy who came in, we hadn't really...
we hadn't scouted him.
Scouted him or planned for.
Yeah.
And it was a different game plan. And that's kind of how they beat us. He was just throwing the ball up for grabs, and their tall... fast receivers were a little bit more capable of getting to the ball than our defensive backs.
Michael Pittman Jr. is just so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was a strange thing that you could actually have their starting quarterback go out and the momentum of the game flipped at that point. So
right. but, I mean, that's just the game, though. And last year, I think, is a great example of that, because this is, you know, Utah's had, I think, three really solid seasons in a row in the Pac-12 where they've been over 9 wins and, you know, like had nine, I think they had a 9-win season, then a 10-win season, and then last year was an 11-year win season. So it's like incremental growth, two back-to-back appearances in the Pac-12 title game. Now, disappointing ends to these seasons, disappointing finishes where they weren't able to win the title game, and last year they weren't able to win their bowl game either. But you'd think if you told me, you know, 10 years ago that we're going to be in the Pac-12 and we're going to be one of the top competing teams and we're going to go 11-3, I'd say that's a great year. But every single game is so important in this sport. And if you can't round it off nicely and sort of end the season on a high note, you know, try to find something to be excited about down the stretch, even if we were just able to win that game against Texas, you know, it might have given it a little bit more of a.
I think the other thing that we like about college football is all of the preparation that goes into it.
Yeah,
to develop a team and to hopefully develop a good team.
Yeah,
you've got all the recruiting, mm-hmm. and you know these coaches. We know we've known coaches personally. Right now, of course. We have a close relationship with Morgan Scally, the defensive coordinator at Utah, because he's married to one of our my dear friend's daughters, to Liz, Hersher Scally. And so we know what kind of schedule they live and how they're on the road all the time. And then you get the off-season training, the weight training, the conditioning, the physical therapy. And then the skills work that they go into, be they a receiver or a quarterback or like a place kicker. And you know, all the work that goes into that. And then they've got the, you know, they have a spring practice, and then they do the fall practices before the season begins. So it's just all that preparation that goes into it that leads up to the season. And
well, and I don't know of another sport that is as much of a team effort.
Team.
Where you really need, you need so many positions to perform well.
Right.
In basketball, if you put LeBron James and Anthony Davis on pretty much any roster in the NBA, there's probably a good shot that you're going to be going deep into the playoffs, if not winding up in the finals, because those two players can make up for a lot of
exactly.
Of ground.
Well, basketball is a five-man, you know, five players on the court at a time from a team, and like you say, two or three. All you need is two or three great players.
Well, and even soccer, it's like if you put Lionel Messi on pretty much any team, it's like, well, you've got a guy that can score almost every game, you know, two or three goals a game. That's kind of all you need to win in that game. Football's not the same way. You can have an incredible receiver, an incredible running back. I mean, just an outstanding, all world quarterback. But if you don't have a line to block for him, if you don't have receivers that can catch the ball, if you don't have a defense that can get you the ball back and put you in positions where it takes every single position to be performing well. And that's a matter of coaching, recruiting, and training, and mentality, getting a team all on the same page. There's few sports that I can think of that really function in such a interdependent.
Well, and if you're a team like Utah, you know, even though you're getting – today they're getting more sought-after recruits, you know you can't go up against the Alabamas, the Ohio States, the Clemsons, even though some of the West Coast schools, Oregon or USC, you can't always compete head-to-head for athletes with those schools. So you have to find what we refer to as a gem in the rough.
Right.
You've got to kind of find players, athletes, that other programs may pass over or may not notice and that you can develop.
Right.
And that's kind of and you know, the guys right now at Utah, like Coach Whittingham and Scally and the others, they've been pretty good at that. They've been pretty good at identifying talent.
I think that's why we like to pull guys up from junior college too, because junior college guys already sort of seem like guys who are passed over for scholarships right out of high school. So it's already guys that maybe the bigger programs were like, we don't think you're quite ready. So they go do a couple of years of junior college, and maybe in those couple of years they really just develop something. Something clicks, and they, you know, they find a next gear that they didn't know they had. And our coaches like to find talent at the junior college level a lot, which I think is a smart route to go. That it's like these are guys that a lot of programs have already given up on and aren't really considering for the next level. But
exactly,
yeah,
exactly, yeah. I think also football can be as it has been for us. It's a family sport.
Yeah,
and families, you know, families can tailgate together, if not just a family, but groups of families.
Yeah.
They can watch together. When you were young, we all went together. And although we didn't always sit in the same spot in the stadium, we'd all go up and spend, an afternoon or an evening together, the ride up, the pregame. And then, of course, you know, we would break down the game and discuss it on the way home. And we would either be elated and happy, or we'd be frustrated and angry and upset. But yeah, it's a family deal, and even watching it together, I think it brings families together and groups of people together.
I think we could talk for probably 2 to 3 hours about things that we love about it. I think we could go into good memories of Utah football and bad memories of Utah football for a long time. And I think that's obvious by the way that we just carry on. But I want to talk a little bit about what's going on this year, since this is where we're at.
Okay.
And college football has begun. I gotta say I was depressed when I turned on the TV yesterday and I was watching other programs play. And even though the stadiums were sort of half full and it was a weird sort of environment, I felt bad that we're being left out. It really feels like a year without Christmas or a year. I've never had in my lifetime a year without this. And so I want to get your take on whether or not you feel like the Pac-12 is doing the responsible thing or the right thing or the smart thing. Obviously, there's a lot of money being lost. And then there's the whole question of players leaving for, I don't know if Utah's lost any players yet, but players going, well, I'm going to go to a school that's playing. I want to play. And I don't know what your feelings on that are.
Yeah. Well, I have mixed feelings. I really don't. I don't pretend to have an answer or to suggest that I know what we should be doing. There are times when I feel like, you know, the Pac-12 and the Big Ten and the Mountain West and a few other conferences have made a mistake because, you know, TV could still carry the games. And the NBA right now seems to be demonstrating that you can carry on competition and do it in a fairly safe way without fans, or for the most part without fans.
NBA is just such a different sport, though. Yeah. So fewer people.
Yeah, fewer people. Yeah. Well, of course, if they had fans, then the arenas are packed, but it's fewer people on the court. Yeah. It's just hard to know, and I go back and forth. I certainly think that the Pac-12 and these other conferences are doing what they feel like is necessary and responsible for the safety, protection of the players, coaches, trainers, support staff, and of course the fans. But that being said, we are missing it, and I do think it's just going to be interesting to see as the season goes on. I think there's a good chance that this whole thing could kind of get sidetracked and derailed mm-hmm. before the season's over, and it may not end up being a complete season. Or there's a chance that if they can commit to the safety protocols that they put in place and not having fans, because on one of the games you and I were watching yesterday, there were like a third of the stadium was full, but the people were all sitting together.
Exactly. And so, like, well, if everyone's going to bunch together.
Yeah. And you know, if that just increases the outbreaks and the incidence of the disease, of the virus.
It'll probably get shut down anyway.
Yeah. So I don't know. I just go back and forth, and I don't really have I know I would like to be watching football. I'd like to be going to games, but I actually do believe that the pandemic is a real thing, that unlike some people, that the coronavirus, COVID-19, can be for some people very, very dangerous and potentially deadly. I think it's, you know, I think the approach we're taking as a world and as countries, you know, erring on the side of caution is probably a good thing.
Oh, my phone. Sorry, dropped my phone.
Oh, okay. But that being said, you know, I do believe we've got to learn to, we've got to try to continue to move life ahead. We can't just stop life and stop all activity. And, you know, not only is college football exciting and fun, it's big business now. And you have areas, lots of businesses, be they food services or hotels, accommodation areas for fans, fan memorabilia, ticket sales. I could go on and on and on. I mean, these are commercial and business streams that have been interrupted and, you know, hopefully can recover.
Oh, I mean, just the restaurant industry. I work in the restaurant industry, and I just know that that's something right there that, like, you know, my restaurant in Pasadena that I work at is down the street from the Rose Bowl. And when there's a game at the Rose Bowl, it's a big deal that we go, okay, there's going to be before the game, we're going to have a massive rush. And after the game, we're going to have a massive rush. And it's going to be, I mean, you know, we're going to sell, you know, $20,000, $20,000, $30,000 in food sales, in those, in those periods. And to just lose that revenue, to just have that pretty much taken completely away from that industry, it's just massive.
It is. And yeah. It affects a lot of lives. Our neighbor across the street, Paul Smith, who's a good friend, and we walk together many mornings for about 90 minutes, he works a lot in the Southeast.
Yeah.
His company headquarters are in Atlanta. He spent a lot of time in Alabama, Mississippi, Florida, so he's very familiar with the Southeast and the Southeast Conference. And he asked about 6 weeks ago, one of his friends down there, he said, well, is the Southeast Conference going to play? And his friend said, well, I'll give you 4 billion reasons why they will. So Southeast Conference football, when you add everything up, the TV revenues, ticket, gate receipts, restaurants, memorabilia, hotels, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, when you add all that up, it rolls up to around $4 billion.
Wow.
So, obviously there's a huge motivation for the Southeast Conference to be playing football, and there's a lot of jobs on the line.
Yeah, it is a weird time to, because even watching those games with like the half empty stands, and there was a photo that was going around online recently of baseball, and it was baseball in California where the skies are kind of torched right now. The skies are, right. are orange and auburn, and someone said, because in the stands right now at baseball stadiums, they have these cardboard cutouts of fans of in the fans. Stands, and someone said, cardboard cutouts of humans watching baseball in an apocalyptic hellscape as photo of the year for 2020. And I thought I don't know if you've seen the movie Interstellar by Christopher Nolan, but the movie takes place in this not too distant future where dust storms have taken over the earth. And there's just everything's kind of shutting down because global warming and climate change. But there's this scene where he takes his kids to go watch the New York Yankees play. But the Yankees are playing at little league stadium, you know? Basically, professional sports have pretty much all but gone away, but they're still going around traveling and doing like little – it's almost like they're a traveling show now, like a relic from the past where people who still want to play baseball go out and the game gets interrupted by a dust storm. But there's probably, 1,000 people in the stands watching this game in this little teeny diamond. They're watching the New York Yankees play. And I thought, looking at that photo and watching the way that people are watching sports right now, it reminds me of like the end times where we try to roll forward and we're trying to go about business as usual, but nothing about it feels like business as usual. Yeah. It kind of feels like we're...
And now that you mention it, maybe what's also compelling about this discussion that we're having today about college football is that college football, in a way, is a microcosm of what we're experiencing in the world overall because of the pandemic.
Exactly.
It's just one element that's been disrupted, one that we are passionate about and we care about and we get excited about. But it has disrupted our entire lives.
Yeah.
And people are wondering and hoping and looking forward to the time when they can return to normalcy.
Something like it.
Yeah. And my personal opinion is we'll never go back to life exactly as it was before the pandemic. We'll adopt a new normal.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect if you could talk to someone who was lucid, who, is in their 90s or even early 100s, who experienced the Great Depression or World War II, they'd tell you the same thing. The world never returns exactly to the same place it was before these significant life-altering events. But I'm also a big believer in the resourcefulness of mankind. We adapt, and we'll adapt to a new way of living that will work until the next big event comes along.
Yeah.
But this thing has altered our lives, and I think it will forever alter our lives. Doesn't mean that it's going to, alter them in a completely bad or detrimental way, but it's going to be different. And so when we do return, we'll return to something a little bit different than what we had before.
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail right on the head. That's exactly why I think that this discussion is pertinent right now. I've wanted to talk about this anyway because it's just something that interests me. I've always thought about, like, why do I care about this thing so much? Yeah. Especially as I get older. Especially as, like, when I was a kid, I kind of looked up to these players and these athletes. But as I get older, I'm like getting very emotionally involved in the trajectory of a bunch of 18 and 19 year old kids who are far younger than me now. Right. But I like analyzing it and thinking about what is it about it that gives me such a thrill and that I enjoy so much. But I wanted to talk about this right now, especially because I think this is the latest thing in a long string of things this year that highlights the profound abnormality of the circumstances we find ourselves in. Yeah.
Well, and it's interesting when you say, why do we get so involved in it? And it's interesting the linkage that something like college football has with people, with friends, and with families. You were too young. I mean, you know this because of history, but you were too young to remember it. But on the night that your grandfather died, mm-hmm. it was in September of 1990. He'd been struggling from a massive stroke that was a result of some surgery that he had in the summer of 1990. So for weeks, we'd been constantly, day after day, visiting him in the rehab center of the hospital and then at a care center. He was partially paralyzed. And of course, as I said earlier, you know, that's where my love of football and attending games came from, is just being with my dad. And it was something we'd always do together and talk about. And on the night of that game, and every day leading up to it, we had been at some point in the day spending an hour or so at the hospital with him. But we had decided to go to the game that night. Yeah. And Utah, I still remember who they were playing. It was a night game. It was a Saturday night. And the University of Hawaii was in town. And we got to the game. And no sooner did we get to the game had barely begun. Now, this is before mobile phones and other, you know, texting and other means of communication. If people had to be called out of a game, and usually it was a doctor.
Yeah.
They'd say, would Dr. So-and-so please go to the white paging phone at the north end of the stadium? And so an announcement came over the public address system that said, would Paul Archer, I think it was Paul or Mike Archer, please go to the white paging phone at the north end of the stadium. Mm. And we got up, and there were some people who knew our family just in our section, because we sat around a lot of people. And I remember one fellow in particular, Bill Pease, a dear friend and neighbor, he said, your dad? And we both looked at him and said, we think so. And he just said, oh, goodness, I hope he's okay. And we went to the phone, and it was our brother Lee.
Yeah.
And he just said, you guys need to get to the hospital quick. Dad's taking a turn for the worse. Well, that was the night he died. And yet, there we were. And I think we kind of went to the game because that's what he would have done with us.
Yep.
And it was a way of celebrating him. And so we went to the game. And you know, we were only there, like I said, a few minutes, and we ended up at the hospital, and he died later that night.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just this memory. And everybody, we had the whole family with us, and Paul had his family, and Kathy, and Lee, of course, Lee was on his way to the game and had stopped by to just say hi to Dad one more time at the care center.
Yeah.
And he could tell that, you know, things weren't right, and that's when he was taken to the hospital.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely when I analyze it, that's probably the thing that ties me the most to it, is that familial connection, that it's sort of just carrying on a legacy of carrying this banner and holding this torch for this program, this sort of arbitrary thing, but it's really more tied to family and to
I think that's what it is. It's like, yeah. I do actually like football, but it's the same thing for me with hunting. I used to pheasant hunt with my dad when I was younger.
Yeah.
I don't do it anymore. I don't care for it. I don't own a shotgun. And I realized as I got older, what I really enjoyed was the time with my father and being with my dad.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to pivot here in the last little bit. You mentioned about the SEC with their, you know, $4 billion industry, and that's just one conference. This is a multi-billion dollar industry across the country. It is between TV revenue and merchandise and all that stuff. I want to talk about how you feel about the ethics of the game. Just a little bit. We've talked so much about the things we love. We've talked a little bit about this year and like the cancellation of the Pac-12 and stuff like that. But I want to get into, I think, to be fair, in the interest of fairness, I want to talk about maybe some of the critiques that people have of the sport and of the industry. There's ethical concerns around the safety of the game and the violence inherent in it. And then also, and this is more of a kind of last couple decades conversation, I feel like, but the concerns around the way that players are compensated, or kind of the lack thereof of compensation for players. And the argument has long been that they're academic athletes, they're not professionals, but the game is not consumed like a non-professional sport. It is not marketed that way. It has major TV deals. Nobody's watching, you know, the University of Utah's soccer match on ABC on a Saturday afternoon, you know, but they're right. Watching college football all day long on Saturday. So I'm just, what are your feelings on the ethics of potentially opening up sponsorships for players and maybe getting to a place where players are compensated a little bit?
Interesting concept. If you go back, you know, 30 years or so, I would have been definitely against it. But I think that was also appropriate for the times because it wasn't big business. Mm-hmm. Coaches didn't make the type of money that they do now. Universities, it was a means of fundraising for them, but it has become one of the principal means of fundraising for many universities across the country.
Right.
Is to bring their alumni in for games, football games or basketball games, and then of course, as a side benefit from that, do fundraising for the different colleges and programs within the university.
Yeah,
and so I think it's really benefited the universities, and as it's become big business, it's really the players who are the workers, the athletes, the stars in this whole thing. And so I think they should be paid. Now, that being said, these are young people.
Yeah.
And I think if we're going to pay them, I think there should be some systems established within college football, within college athletics and the NCAA that gives a lot of help to athletes on how to manage their money.
Yeah.
You know, I've long said that the professional sports should do that too, because I think one of the great travesties of our time are these athletes that make massive sums of money and a good percentage of them. In some sports, they say it's as high as 50, 60, 70% within 10 years of retiring or broke.
Yeah.
And that's crazy considering how much they made. And there just needs to be, if we're going to pay them, there needs to be a lot of education on how to manage money. Most of us learn to manage money a bit at a time.
Yeah.
And it comes ratably over time. And we don't go from earning nothing to, you know, $1 billion.
Yeah.
And then, oh, yeah, I need to buy a new car. I need to get a boat. I need it, you know.
I mean, this happens to child stars too, who have a career where they, you know, they take off at, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old. And it's like, I made $30 million by the time I was 15, you know, in movies. And like, you know, a lot of times they have parents who go, we're going to put this in a fund or, you know, but.
I would be in favor. So I'm now in favor of paying to some degree the players, but helping them, at least giving them a lot of education on how to manage their financial affairs. I do believe coaches, and again, it's a free market system, I guess, to a degree, but I think compensation is ridiculous. But
right.
you know, it is what it is. But I mean,
the job is hard, as we discussed.
It's hard
recruiting, and I mean, it is a year-round, grueling.
I think they should be compensated very.
But people being compensated in a
very
tune of
strong way, but
$6 million a year, you know, stuff like that. It's like, well, I mean,
But that's not just football. You could take that argument and apply it to many businesses and industries and institutions in this world. And so,
but at least, you know, in professional sports, the players are also being compensated.
Right.
And I just think that trying to compare college football to other college sports, even college basketball, it's like, it's just not the same on a numbers.
Well, college basketball, men's college basketball would be the closest.
Would be the closest,
football.
But it still isn't. I don't think it generates nearly
the
as much.
One area where it does is the NCAA basketball tournament. That's
right.
the best non-professional playoff tournament in the United States.
Yeah.
As far as revenue production.
Right. They probably
but the
make
regular
up for
season
it with,
of basketball yeah. doesn't compare to the regular football season.
They also probably make up for it with just quantity because they can have more games and more events.
But yeah, my feeling is I think we should pay the players and you know, do it in a reasonable way.
Careful
do
with
it
with that.
Do it with yeah. do it with a lot of education. Mm. I'm okay with that. But that being said, you're still going to have a caste system because you're probably going to have a few players on every team getting very well compensated. And I doubt you can just go in and say, okay, we got 90 players on the team. We're going to have X amount of compensation for the team, and we're going to divide it by 90, and everybody gets the same amount. I don't think that's going to work because your stars are the people that are bringing in the fans to the seats and, you know, the TV revenues and so forth. Unfortunately, the guy who's sitting on the bench and who's just a backup, you know, the 89th or the 90th player, won't get as much, but at least they'll get an education.
Well, there would have to be
as they do now.
There would have to be just some kind of contract negotiation. The kids would probably have to get an agent. You know, right out of high school, you'd probably have to get a sports agent who would help negotiate your contract. It would be very similar to entering the NFL. I think it first clicked for me in 2008 when the Utes went undefeated and beat Alabama. I remember EA Games that year, their NCAA college football game came out, and Brian Johnson was the cover of it. So the cover of the game was Brian Johnson, you know, dropping back to throw a pass. And I remember thinking, that's really cool that the University of Utah quarterback is like the cover guy for this game. And then I looked it up. Is he getting compensated for this? And there was a big controversy that no, he was not. And I remember thinking, and none of the players in the game, they're all represented.
Right.
And I thought, I've been, you know, acting in TV and commercials since I was a little kid. I would never do anything like this, appear in anything like this, if I wasn't being compensated
right.
for it.
Right.
And this guy's, you know, this guy's performing for hundreds of thousands of people. He's got so many more fans and so much more exposure than I do. And now he's on the cover of this video game that's going to sell millions of copies, and he's not getting anything for it. And it sort of clicked to me that, like, that's not right. That doesn't especially. And he wound up having a career as a coach, and I think he's doing all right.
He's done okay.
But there's so many players that aren't in his position who, you know. I just think it makes sense. It seems to make sense that the numbers are there. That and again, it's like I talked about this on my episode about Hale Center Theater, where it's like nobody's getting tricked. The players know what they're signing up for when they go to play for a school. They know that they're not getting paid. They know that they're just getting school paid for. And I think they get a stipend. I think the NCAA allows them to have like a food stipend and stuff, and that's part of their scholarship package. But so nobody's getting, you know, duped here. But again, it's like these are kids that would that love football so much and that want and that are so excited about the opportunity of potentially going pro or having a coaching career that they are willfully allowing themselves to sort of be exploited.
Yeah. And yeah. So but I will say this. I mean, I am in favor of some type of pay for the players. I'd be okay with that.
Yeah.
But that being said, if it doesn't happen, I still think the system provides a lot of benefits and has for some time and continues to for the college athlete. first and foremost, they get their education paid for, which mm-hmm. today, as we move forward, is becoming a bigger and bigger benefit, because the cost of a college education today for many people in this country is almost out of reach.
Yeah, especially if you get a scholarship to a school like Stanford or something.
You can get a college education out of it. Number two, you learn a lot about discipline, focus, leadership, and as you mentioned earlier, team participation, how to work as a team. And there are relationships that are formed through this experience that can be that can last throughout life and can open up other opportunities down the road, even career opportunities for these athletes. So I still think that it has been and continues to be a good system for athletes, whether they're paid or they're not. I'm okay with them being paid as we move forward.
Right.
But even if they're not, there's still a lot of benefits there. And for the few that are skilled enough and have the type of body type to go on and do their sport professionally, of course, they definitely will get paid for it or can get paid for it.
Right.
Now, the other thing you asked about that I think also is one I think about often, as much as I like football, is this issue of player safety.
Yeah.
And, you know, we used to consider football up until about, well, when did CTE come on the horizon? When did we discover CTE?
90s?
Like, or late 90s or early 2000s, somewhere in there. But before that, we always considered football just a contact sport, you know, where you could get bumps, bruises, some breaks, maybe a concussion or two.
Maybe Joe Theismann snaps his leg in half. Who knows?
Yeah, but I mean, but, you know, not life-threatening. But what we've now realized is that sports like football, and football being, you know, one of the most identifiable in this way, that repeated head trauma can, in many individuals, lead to these conditions like chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE. And sometimes I think as a society, we should maybe just say, no more football. And none of my children played football.
Right.
We all go, we all enjoy it together. We all enjoy watching games. Even my grandkids like it. But nobody's played it, and I was okay with that. I was really okay with it because I think I realized, even before I was aware of CTE, that it was a it could be really hard on the body. And so, on the one hand, I feel a little bit like the Roman citizens that used to go watch gladiators.
Yeah,
and you know what? We look at that now and go, oh, that was weird. That
barbaric,
was barbaric,
brutish.
Yeah, barbaric, and all of that, but. Isn't that kind of what we do with football? Now, that being said, they are trying. They've made tremendous strides in trying to make the game safer with certain rules in the game now. You can't lead with your head. You know, you can't hit somebody in the head. You can't knee somebody in the head.
Yeah.
Or at least you're not supposed to, and you get penalized and can even be held out of games if you do. The equipment's better, but... Yeah, I mean, I for one, my conscience suggests to me that if the governing bodies of the sport, the NCAA and professional sports, came out and said, hey, we've had a great run, but due to the safety concerns for all of our players, we're closing down, you know, I would understand it. But I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's too much a part of our society, and I think... The good thing is I think players today at least understand or should understand, and coaches and trainers and doctors understand, there is a risk to participating in the sport.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem on the surface to be more violent than, say, boxing or ultimate fighting, because ultimate fighting, the goal is to just hurt and knock out your opponent.
Well, they're violent too.
But I think that, I love the sport, but I can't help but feel a little guilty. Like, I love Britton Covey. I love how shifty the guy is. I love his athleticism. I love how quick he is. But man, he was 5'6" and 170 pounds. And every time he took a hit, I I kind of felt bad that he had to be out. I just, these guys that outweigh him by 50 pounds are just coming full speed at him. And he was, I mean, to his credit, he's a tough guy. He knows how to bounce back up and take a hit, but boy, teams like to key on him because they know we can probably make this guy a little scared to catch the ball. We can, you know, intimidate him into maybe thinking twice before.
Plus, let's face it, if you're 210, 220 pounds, you're not afraid to go hit a 170-pound guy.
No.
It's like when you're a teenager beating up on a younger kid. I mean,
I can't help but feel bad.
There's no intimidation factor.
I feel bad when I see that stuff. I feel it kind of, I mean, and then you see stuff like Alex Smith and stuff like that where, I mean, obviously there's, that happens, that's kind of a freak accident where that happens in basketball. Like Gordon Hayward had an injury like that. And Alex Smith, I think what happened to him, it's like, I don't think anyone would have guessed that that injury would have wound up almost killing him, that he would have had flesh-eating bacteria that was in jeopardy of, you know, getting into his bloodstream and killing him from breaking his leg like that. But it is a little bit like you sit there and think, are we being a little bit barbaric here? The difference is, the major difference, as you described, is obviously people in the Roman times were forced to fight in the gladiatorial arena, and football players and people who participate in contact sports are doing it voluntarily with the full knowledge.
Presumably, they're not forced.
Yeah, presumably they fully understand that the game is full contact, and if anything, you talk to a lot of them, that's their favorite thing about it. They're like, "Oh, I love, there's nothing like the feeling of leveling a guy, of lowering your shoulder and dropping a guy to the ground. You know, there's nothing like the feeling of and you know, vice versa. They go, there's nothing like the first time you get knocked on your ass in college football. You come out of high school and you go, "Oh, I'm in a new game now." You know, the first time someone knocks you down. And then I've also heard that the first time you go to the NFL and get hit, you go, "Oh."
Yeah.
I sort of blacked out there for 3 seconds.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't play the sport. I never have. I don't know what it feels like to get hit like that. I don't know what it feels like to hit someone like that. I don't know the psychology of the people who are doing it. I don't know if they feel like they have to do it, if there's pressure from their family to do it or what. So it's hard to comment on specifically.
Well, look, as we mentioned, going back to the Roman times and the Greek with Greek wrestling and the Roman gladiators, boxing, you know, ultimate fighting, whatever it is. There's always been a desire within people to find out who the fastest, strongest, most
toughest,
proficient is.
Yeah,
and you know, football just fits into that category. And so, I think for a lot of people, it's just something they want to do.
Yeah,
and the exhilaration. I mean, there's probably nothing like, you know, getting behind a defender and catching a pass behind the defense and running away from them, or breaking through the line and juking, you know, a couple of players and then being off to the races, or running over somebody at the goal line, or sacking the quarterback. I mean, there's all these moments of exhilaration in the game that players just live for.
And they're so exhilarating because they come – again, stakes. Like, anytime you do something incredible in football, there are 11 guys who are trying to kill you while you're doing it. There's 11 guys who are trying to hurt you, and you're having to avoid all of them while you're doing it. So breaking tackles or you know, a quarterback escaping an attempted sack, and you know, as he's going down, he throws a 30-yard pass that gets caught. You know, it's like when these amazing things happen, it's usually in the midst of avoiding pain.
And then the other thing that's kind of unique, or not unique, but interesting about football, most of the game, like 95% of the game, is about athleticism, speed, strength, and just brute strength. And yet, then there's this one little element that's all on a specific skill. being able to, and it kind of brings soccer back into the game, kick a, what's a football shape, oblong?
Yeah, an oval.
Oval shape.
Yeah.
40 or 50 yards through these uprights that are about 20 feet across.
It's one of the strangest parts of the game. It almost doesn't fit.
You can throw soccer in there, golf. It's like, you know, shooting for a target. And
there's this one person on the team, on every team, who doesn't do what anyone else does.
Doesn't hit anybody.
His only job is to be able to kick that ball far and accurate.
Accurately.
Yeah. And also the punter, too, where it's like the skill of being able to drop a ball, kick it, and try to pin it down on the one-yard line or something like that, you know. And you have such a specific skill set there. Yeah, it's so fascinating. Anyway, I don't think that I don't expect us to have the answer to what football should do to address its violence or its issues around whether or not players should be paid. But I do think I just wanted to make sure that we addressed it in a conversation about it, that we're not ignoring the fact that there are legitimate and valid concerns around the ethics of the game and with player compensation and player safety. And I don't really know what the solution there is. I believe players should be compensated. I don't know what to do about violence. And I also don't know what compensation would really look like. I just think that something in addition to scholarship and the experience and everything like that.
And I agree with you totally. And I guess my rationalization on both of those is that I rationalize my interest in support of football this way. Well, at least they're discussing the compensation issues, and it's something that will be well discussed and well thought out. And second, on the safety issues, at least there's a lot of issues that are now known, understood, and I assume are being explained to players and coaches. And so they're moving forward kind of with their own agency and free will intact. They're not being forced to do this. Now, that might be a rationalization. Maybe somebody with a greater emotion over safety would say, no, even though they know this, we should not be playing the game because it's too dangerous. But, you know, that's not for me to decide. And like I said, if it ended tomorrow because of that, I would miss it, but I wouldn't think those that brought the game to an end I wouldn't think ill of them or that they had done something inappropriate because they're looking out for the health and safety of other people.
Right. Okay. I think that's everything that I wanted to cover, and we're well over our time. So, and I, like I said, I think we could talk forever about everything we love about the sport. There's many, many, many games that we probably didn't cover and aspects of the game and storylines from our past. Anyway, it was nice to just talk about this with you. And
it was.
Especially since we don't get to...
Yeah, this is as good as it gets for we Utah fans right now.
Exactly. It's just reminiscing about seasons past and thinking about what maybe lies ahead in the future. We'll see. Cool. Well, thanks, Dad. So if you've been listening to this show for a while and you're surprised that my dad and I went long, then I don't know what to tell you, because you already know by now that I'm a verbose person who has no short way of saying anything, and my dad, that's who I get that from. We talk. When we're at a party, we suck up a lot of the hot air in the room because we are the talkers. We are the storytellers, and that's another big thing that we have in common is we love telling stories. We love talking at length and in depth with good friends and good company, and I get that from him, and I'm not ashamed of it. You know, there was a time in my life where I was a little bit ashamed that I was such a talker, but not anymore. I'm cool with it. I'm at peace with it. That's about all I have to say. There's not really much to unpack there. It's just college football, you know, and just this year is weird. I don't know. Yeah. Let me know your thoughts. Hit me up on the People Pleaser Instagram. Write me. Let me know how you're feeling, how you're doing. Go leave a review on Apple Podcasts. You can leave a 5-star review and say what you think about the show, and I'll review you back on the air. Music videos out on YouTube. Go watch the music video for New Groove. It's only got like 180 views right now. That's not enough. Go watch that music video. Go watch it. I worked hard on it. Kramer worked hard on it. Kramer at Kramer England, who shot and edited that music video, he worked hard on it. Go watch. It looks great. It's great. The song, great. The song mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn over at Marmalade Music. This show, People Pleaser, is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You heard at the beginning there the University of Utah fight song, the fanfare that I threw in there. So I didn't write that, obviously, but that's the Utah fight song. And then everything else is done by me. The show is mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn over at Marmalade Music. You know, the same guy that mixes and masters my music. You can go to marmalademusicslc.com. Let Chris know that you listen to People Pleaser, and he'll do your first audio project for 20% off. It's a hell of a deal. You should go do that. And then, guys, this is crazy. This is crazy. I have an album coming out in 2 days. It's the album that I've been talking about forever on this show. It comes out in 2 days. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know what else to say about it. Like, I think next week, Chris and I might be doing like a full discussion, like an episode in-depth discussion on the album, just because it's a big thing. It's a big deal. We worked really, really hard on this album, and it comes out on Friday. So if this show I post, usually I post People Pleaser on Wednesday night and people listen to it on Thursday morning. So if you're listening to it on Thursday, the album comes out tomorrow. And if you're listening to it on Friday, September 25th, if it's September 25th right now while you're listening to this episode, the album's out. You can go on Apple Music and Spotify right now and listen to the full album, Beautiful Things by Austin Archer. So you should go do that. If it's Saturday, the album's been out for 24 hours already, and you missed the album drop, but it's not too late to go listen to it. So don't think that you missed it. You can still go watch the music video on YouTube, and you can listen to the album. You can do all those things. I know it's like asking a lot, but I think you can do it. Go listen to the album on like a drive. Go take a nice, pretty drive and listen to the album, start to finish. Or go take like a run and listen to it. It's fun to run to. There's lots of different colors in there, lots of different vibes. Or like smoke some weed and like lie down in the middle of your floor and put the album on and listen to the whole thing. Anyway, okay.